Jerome Ji and visiting Taipei Minister Thaksin Shinawatra discuss stronger ties between their countries and a free trade agreement. Still insisting on a political solution, China says the current circumstances in Iraq do not warrant a new UN security resolution. False in Washington, Pyongyang threatens to pull out of their armistice agreement and so urges direct talks between the two sides. And the suspect in an arson attack on a subway in South Korea, which has killed 130 people, is believed to be mentally ill. Hello and welcome. I'm Li Xin in Beijing. The Thai Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra is in Beijing for a two-day visit aimed at further strengthening relations with China. Thaksin held talks with Premier Jurong Ji earlier today. A proposed free trade agreement between China and Thailand is expected to be on their agenda. Thaksin's visit comes less than a month after he met visiting Chinese Vice Premier Li Lanqing in Bangkok. Booming trade has increased Sino-Thai friendship since the two neighbors forged formal links in 1975. Annual trade volume has reached up to $7 billion, more than 30 times the figure in 1970s. The Thai leader is scheduled to meet President Jiang Zemin and Vice President Hu Jintao on Wednesday, and this is Thaksin's fifth visit to China. China says that under current circumstances, the UN Security Council Resolution 1441, not a new one, should be the framework to resolve the Iraqi crisis. A foreign ministry spokesperson said on Tuesday that it is now urgent to continue to solve the Iraqi crisis within the United Nations framework.
We think at present the regulation under the framework of Resolution 1441 have not yet been exhausted, and there is still room for more efforts. We should continue to solve the Iraqi crisis under such a framework.
While urging Iraq to fully cooperate with weapons inspectors, Zhang Qiyue said political means should remain the method to solve the crisis. She also confirmed that U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell will visit China soon. The 15 European Union leaders issued a joint statement after an emergency meeting on Iraq Monday. They agreed that the use of force should be the last resort, but that arms inspections should not go on indefinitely. Zhu Yan has the story.
The leaders agreeing that Iraq should be disarmed urged Baghdad to comply fully and immediately with the United Nations resolutions or face serious consequences. In a joint statement aimed at bridging the gap among EU members, the leaders urged that UN inspectors should have more time in Iraq if needed. The statement set no time limit on the inspection process but said it could not continue indefinitely in the absence of full Iraqi cooperation. Britain, supported by Spain, Italy, Denmark and Portugal, have challenged the EU to send out a tough message to Saddam and said the time to disarm peacefully could not be open-ended.
And I think there is nothing more important for us in Europe at the moment than to send that strong, unequivocal signal. Iraq will be disarmed of weapons of mass destruction, whether it is done peacefully or by conflict.
But France backed to varying degrees in European ranks by Germany, Belgium, Sweden, Finland, Austria, Luxembourg and Greece in opposing any rush to war said only the UN inspectors could determine when the process should end. The EU summit was widely seen as a fresh test for US-European relations fraught by tensions over Iraq at the United Nations and in NATO. Zhu Yan, CCTV.
The first U-2 surveillance flight over Iraq took place on Monday as part of the ongoing UN disarmament mission amid a looming US-led war on Iraq. According to the Iraqi Foreign Ministry, the plane entered Iraqi airspace and surveyed several areas. The operation went on for 4 hours and 20 minutes. Such a flight satisfied a long-standing demand by the United Nations following the resumption of UN arms inspections in Iraq last November. Last Monday, Iraq agreed on UN demands for American U-2, French Mirage and Russian Antonov surveillance flights aimed at reinforcing the inspection for Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction. The Turkish daily Hürriyet reported on Tuesday that Turkey and the United States have reached an understanding on a co-command of troops in northern Iraq if a US-led war breaks out. 40,000 to 55,000 Turkish soldiers will go to northern Iraq and 2 commanders, 1 Turkish and 1 American, will be in charge. Turning to Asia, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has threatened to pull out of the armistice agreement that suspended the Korean War in 1953, accusing the United States of violating the terms of the agreement. Meanwhile, Republic of Korea President Kim Dae-jung has called for direct talks between Pyongyang and Washington. Wang Dewei has this story.
The Korean People's Army of the DPRK warned on Monday of a possible withdrawal from its obligations under the armistice agreement, accusing the United States of using the agreement to implement its hostile policy against the DPRK. A KPA spokesman said there would be no obligation for the DPRK to remain bound to the agreement if the United States continues to violate and misuse it. He said the future of the agreement depends entirely on the U.S. side. Meanwhile, in Seoul, outgoing ROK President Kim Dae-jung has urged direct talks between the DPRK and the U.S. Speaking to tourism officials on Monday, Kim Dae-jung said he believes there is little possibility of U.S. military action against Pyongyang. He called for direct DPRK-U.S. talks to prevent the tense situation developing into open conflict.
DPRK-U.S. talks were important because the problem can only be solved in this way. DPRK wants its security guaranteed, and the United States can do so.
Kim Dae-jung, who is due to end his term as ROK president next Tuesday, warned that the DPRK could trigger an atomic arms race in Northeast Asia in its quest to triumph in the nuclear confrontation with the U.S. He warned that the production of atomic weapons by Pyongyang could force his country and Japan to build nuclear arms as well. On the way, CCTV.
China's Vice Foreign Minister Wang Yi held talks Tuesday morning with DPRK Foreign Minister Paik Nam Son in Beijing. Paik was en route to the upcoming International Non-Alliance Movement Conference in Malaysia. Both sides agreed the nuclear issue on the Korean Peninsula should be resolved through peaceful means and dialogue. About 130 people were killed following an arson attack on a subway train in Daegu in South Korea on Tuesday. Police apprehended a male suspect in a hospital who is receiving treatment for burns on his legs. It has been reported that the suspect is believed to be mentally ill. Wei Hong has more details.
As many as 600 passengers were aboard a train when the fire started at around 10 a.m. local time in Daegu, the fourth largest city in the country. More than 140 of them were reported injured. Hospital officials fear the death toll may continue to rise as most of the injured inhale the toxic gases. Police say there are still a number of people trapped inside the subway.
I cannot give the exact number, but people who are trapped in the subway are in a dangerous situation.
Police say the 56-year-old male named Kim Dae-han has been transferred to a police station from the hospital. There were no further details available. However, doctors did say he was going to undergo psychiatric tests. Witnesses said they saw him pouring flammable liquid onto subway seats and setting them on fire with his lighter. Passengers tried in vain to stop him from starting the fire. The city's subway has been in suspension due to the accident. The outgoing South Korean President Kim Dae-jung dispatched Lee Hyun-sik, the Minister of Administration and Local Autonomy, to the southern city to direct the rescue work. Daegu city officials have also set up a center to oversee the tragedy. Wei Hong, CCTV.
Still ahead, after a short break, the Deutsche Bank chief executive and five others are charged for their huge payments to managers in the management telecom takeover. And Chinese bank on savings accounts to keep their money safe is January seeing 370 billion yuan in deposits.
In the name of peace, the United States will lead a coalition of the willing to disarm the Iraqi regime.
Israel's new parliament convened for the first time on Monday as Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and his main rival discussed forming a coalition government to address the country's security and economic crises. The new parliament consists of 13 parties. Sharon's Likud party holds one third of the seats in the House, but he still needs coalition partners to form a majority governing team. The shape of Sharon's new government could determine how Israel deals with the Palestinians. If the moderate Labour Party headed by Amram Mitzma joins, it could signal a readiness to soften current policies and reopen peace negotiations. Turkish Prime Minister Abdullah Gül is seeking to allay fears that plans to reunify Cyprus might fall apart after opposition leader Tasos Papadopoulos stormed to victory in the Greek Cypriot presidential election. As Hoyer reports, the UN deadline for a solution to the Cyprus issue is only 10 days away.
From Brussels, Jewel said on Monday that Turkey and the Turkish Cypriots were working hard to reach a satisfactory reunification agreement.
The solution should be satisfactory for the both sides, of course. We are working hard. I am optimistic.
Okay. The UN blueprint for Cyprus calls for two largely self-governing ethnic zones under central government of Greeks and Turks. But both Greek and Turkish Cypriots are not satisfied at the UN plan because both sides have to make concessions. Papadopoulos, who says the complex UN plan is a basis for talks but is not good enough, sees veteran President Glasgow's clarity in a stunning victory on Sunday, which sparked fears that the reunification plan may fall apart. The prospect of a divided Cyprus entering the European Union under the Greek Cypriot flag in 2004 bodes ill for Turkey's EU membership hopes and raises problems for the bloc itself. Turkey's decades-old aspirations to join the European Union partly hinge on moving towards a settlement on Cyprus. Korean, CCTV.
Indian President APJ Kalam on Monday declared that the ambitious 8% economic growth in the country's 10th plan is achievable. In his first address to the joint sitting of Parliament, he also indicated that the budget would restructure the tax system in the country based on the plans laid out by the Kalkar Economic Panel. Prosecutors in Germany have charged the Deutsche Bank chief executive Joseph Ackermann and five others for their huge payments to managers of telecom giant Mannesmann when it was bought by Vodafone in 2000. The deal was worth about $200 billion at the time, making it the world's largest takeover. Chen Yi has more details.
Ackermann and Klaus Zwickel, head of Germany's influential in-game Mattel trade union, were among six people charged by the Düsseldorf state prosecutor on Monday, following a breach of trust investigation that lasted almost 2 years. Ackermann and Zwickel were members of the Mannesmann supervisory board that approved severance payments and bonuses, estimated at more than 100 million euros to executives of the company. Vodafone bought Mannesmann, Germany's second largest mobile phone operator, in the year 2000. After months of bitter fighting that pushed Mannesmann's shares to record levels, management recommended the bid, and a number of top executives, including former Mannesmann chief executive Klaus Esser, received the payments. Iggy Metall is the only party so far to comment on the charges.
Herr Zwickel hat diesen Millionenbeträgen nie zugestimmt.
Mr. Zwickel never agreed with the payment of millions. Therefore, we believe that the accusations of the state attorney are baseless. We expect the quick rehabilitation of the IG Metall chairman.
Vodafone has been arguing that it merely honored its contractual obligations after the takeover. A spokesman for the Düsseldorf court said it could be months before a decision was taken on whether to admit the case. CCTV.
China's financial sector continued to prosper in January. Making the biggest news was the increase in private savings deposits, which now total almost 10 trillion yuan or 1.2 trillion US dollars. The growth has prompted analysts to call for the expansion of domestic consumption and the diversification of investment channels. Our reporter Zhang Lu takes a closer look.
According to statistics released by the People's Bank of China, by the end of January, saving deposits of private individuals amounted to 9.81 trillion yuan or 1.18 trillion US dollars, surging by 20% year on year. The growth rate has been the highest since 1998. In January alone, savings deposits totaled 371.6 billion yuan, 240 billion yuan more than the same period last year. Experts put the increase in savings mainly down to China's fast economic growth and the income rises it has brought with it.
Last year, our country's GDP growth rate reached 8%, the highest in 4 years. This resulted in a fast increase of workers' revenues. Last year, the income of urban residents increased by 12%, while that of rural residents grew by 5.3%. This growth in income directly led to the huge increase in savings deposits.
Xu Hongyuan also pointed out that the faster growth of savings deposits means that savers are reluctant to expand their investment opportunities and that their investment channels are limited. He says it shows that the government policy of expanding domestic consumption is not as effective as expected.
Our policies still need improvement, and they could still play an important role in expanding domestic consumption.
With savings deposits in China accounting for around 38% of the country's GDP, the country is one of the world's highest savings deposits rates. Experts believe that this could be an impetus for both the development of the country's capital market and its economy, but the key is to successfully reform the financial sector and to give people more choices for diverse and secure investment.
Turning to the stock markets, China's Shanghai and Shenzhen indices both closed lower on Tuesday. Uncertainties over how long the Iraqi crisis will drag on pulled oil prices away from two-year peaks on Tuesday and undermined Asian stocks and the dollar ahead of Wall Street's return from a long weekend. Now a close look at the figures. We'll be right back. Coming up on this edition of Worldwide Watch, China looks at the role of life science and biotechnology in the global economy and social development. And four Asian countries seek to clear the air on the province caused by dust and sandstorms.
What color do you see in your eyes? Is it gray, blue, or even red? You may see only one side of the story. CCTV 9 shows you the real China, revealing the whole spectrum of this fascinating country. CCTV 9, your first window on China.
Science and biotechnology play an important role in the global economy and in social development. To further promote China's biotech industry, a conference entitled New Century Forum on Life Sciences is being held in Beijing Tuesday. Mao Shiji has this story.
Three Nobel laureates, Drs. Robert Huber and Hamid Mischel from Germany and Dr. Torsten Musil from the United States, were among the invited guests who delivered speeches at the forum. The development of modern life sciences has attracted worldwide attention in recent years, as belief grows that biotechnology will help solve many urgent problems, such as overpopulation, food supply, healthcare, and environmental protection. Many scientists even predict the biotech industry will overtake the IT industry to become major growth area of the world economy in the 21st century. One of the Nobel Prize winners says China's biotech market appeal has attracted a large influx of young talent as overseas Chinese students return to take up positions at home. He also expressed his optimism about China's biotech development.
I'm sure not only an understanding of in basic biology, but also in biotechnology, in agriculture, in many areas, provide economic benefit for the country, jobs for the people working here. And so I think the future for life sciences in this country, I think, are bright.
After two decades of development, China's biotechnology standards are among the best among developing countries. Modern biotechnology sciences have gained extensive applications in the agricultural and pharmaceutical sectors. For instance, crop breeding techniques are generating huge economic value in China. The yield of super hybrid rises as high as 12 tons per hectare. China has also been one of the first countries to carry out gene therapy in the medical field, and Chinese scientists have discovered several disease genes, including the neuro-deaf gene. Mao Xijie, CCTV.
Finally, dust and sandstorms have been a regional environmental problem in recent years in Northeast Asia. China, South Korea, Japan and Mongolia are the most affected. Government officials and experts from the four countries met Tuesday in Beijing to hash out a practical solution to the problem. Wang Chonghui has the latest.
The strong greedy winds blowing through drought-striking area is now a regular occurrence in Mongolia and several provinces in northern China. Serious deforestation is the root cause of the climate change. Human intervention such as overplowing and overgrazing has also led to the problem. Many experts say that Mongolia and China should be the two major countries to combat sandstorms.
Mongolia, about 70% of the land of the total territory of Mongolia is somehow degraded to whatever this extent. And the desertification area is moving forward from south to the north. It's rapidly increasing for the last few years. And because it is really originated from Mongolia and part of China. It's the problem of yellow sand or sapphire sandstone is becoming really a regional problem.
To tackle with the issue, which is currently a regional problem, experts and government officials from four Asian countries discussed the problem in today's seminar. With support from the international financial institutes, the countries launched a joint project to prevent sandstorms in the region. It is an additional step following the environmental ministerial meeting between China, Japan, and South Korea last year, where they agreed to a program to solve the problem.
After that, Chinese government make a full preparation for launching this project in the technical level. At the same time, Asian Development also confirm its support for this project at the funding of $1 billion in the next 18 months for formulating an investment plan for yellow sand in Northeast Asia.
The project financed by ADB is aimed at establishing a regional cooperation mechanism for the prevention and control of the storm, such as monitoring network and early warning system. The project will also include shared data and technical information. The four countries have responded positively to the project plans.
Japan, we observe more and more yellow sand occurrence. So now Japanese society has much attention to this program.
The four Asian countries all agree that it takes a lot of joint efforts and money to solve the sandstorm problem. An expert at meeting also called for patience, stressing that ecological recovery will take some time. Wang Honghui, CCTV.
With that, we end this edition of Worldwide Watch. But before we go, we treat you with pictures from Hawaii, where the world's most active volcano, Kilauea, is sending out molten lava. And after that, domestic and international weather forecasts. I'm Lucien in Beijing. Thank you for joining us. Thank you.
I'm going to go to the hospital.